healthcare. Bill, what's the next big thing on the agenda?
In addition to continuing to fight about the healthcare bill?
No, I mean, that's only the beginning.
Yeah, so I don't think anything of that scale. I think the big U.S. debate now will be deficit and how to manage the deficit. The president has some global warming issues that'll be fought about a bit.
The economy's on the mend.
Economy's on the mend, but in kind of a jobless sort of mend. You know, the profits are better because productivity's up, but the unemployment rates are. Morning. Good morning. My name is Steve Goldsmith. I'm your moderator, and we took a poll before the session started, and there really are twice as many people present as we had expected. We figured that you were either asleep or fixated on how to get out of the country, so we appreciate your presence today. We're going to have a discussion about government and its role with social entrepreneurship, and I'm going to ask each of the panelists to briefly introduce themselves and what their entity does. We have a mixture up here today between government and NGO types. The two of us on this side represent government. The two over there represent whatever the other sector is. And we're going to talk about the relationship between them. My name is Steve Goldsmith. I run a Center on Innovation at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. I'm also chairman of the U.S. agency that is the parent of the President's Social Innovation Fund. It's called the Corporation National Community Service. We call ourselves a corporation, but we're essentially a government agency, and we're the U.S. parent of essentially the domestic Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, and VISTA, and Senior Service, and now we're the proud owners of a $50 million Presidential Social Innovation Fund, and we're in the process of trying to figure out how to spend that, so we'll talk about that. So I think I'm here as a this is a great opportunity for me because I can pretend to be the moderator as a Harvard professor, but I actually can lobby as a U.S. government official. So I'm going to ask myself a lot of questions and then compliment myself on the answers. I'm going to ask each of the panelists to self-introduce themselves, but mostly about what their organizations do, just briefly, and then we'll have a conversation with lots of questions from the audience. Let me start with a government official who's to my left. Dr. Vivian Balakrishnan, who is also a surgeon and Minister for Community Development, Youth, Sports from Singapore. And then after that, after he introduces himself, I'll ask Alistair Wilson, Chief Executive of the School of Social Entrepreneurs in London, to talk just for a few minutes about his organization. And Ilse Turnicht, whose name I've mispronounced, I'm sure. There's too many R's in your name, Ilse, who will pronounce her name and introduce her organization, who's a CEO of the Mars Discovery District in Toronto. So with that, Dr. Vivian.
Thank you. I'm Vivian Balakrishnan from Singapore. This is a very tiny dot on the map, 30 kilometers from east to west, on which 5 million people live. I'm from the Ministry of Community Development, Youth and Sports. Youth and sports is the fun part. Community development is where all the political tension occurs. It's the equivalent, I presume, of your Department of Social Affairs, which means the social security, gender equality, management of race, language, and religion, management of integration with immigration, and all the other unpopular stuff which no one else wants to do, I'm in charge of, which means I get onto the firing line quite often. So I hope we'll have an equally fiery session today. All yours.
Thank you. My name is Alistair Wilson. I'm from the School for Social Entrepreneurs. School for Social Entrepreneurs started in London 12 years ago. It was founded by a chap called Michael Young, who was a serial social entrepreneur based in the UK. He invented, over his lifetime, institutions like the Open University, Language Line, Which Magazines, the Consumers Association, about 40 national and international social enterprises and charities that have scaled. Michael died about 6 years ago. One of the last organizations that he started was the School for Social Entrepreneurs, and he started this because he believed, weirdly, that you couldn't teach entrepreneurship or social entrepreneurship because he believed you could learn it by doing, which is what he felt he had done all his life. So he set up an institution where people come with ideas of what they are passionate about, what they want to make happen, often from their neighborhoods or from their personal experience, and they spend a year on an action learning program with 20 of their peers, if you like, 20 people in the room with an idea. They come together once a week. The rest of the time they spend working up that idea, and they hear from what we call witnesses, so people like yourselves, entrepreneurs who've been there, seen it, and done it. And we ask the entrepreneurs who come in as witnesses to park their ego at the door and tell the real story and the dreadful story of the sleepless nights and how awful it was and how many battles they've had and how difficult the whole procedure was. Because we believe that by unpicking these stories and sharing these stories, obviously the transference of a lot of soft skills happens as opposed to the kind of hard skills necessary to conceive of and create a social venture operation. And what we're talking about by soft skills are things like what gives you the right, you know, to do this idea of yours? You and whose army are going to start this up? So it's things like confidence, legitimacy, attitude, mindset, behavior. Now, Michael felt very strongly that these were the higher order skills that social entrepreneurs faced in their infancy when they were starting things off, particularly if you weren't from a privileged background, but actually you truly understood the heart of the problem because you lived it, your neighbours lived it, your community lives it, and you had a vested interest in doing something about it. So the school conceived itself really to try and address soft skills and try and use social entrepreneurship as a tool to devolve power to people who understood the problem and therefore were in a great place to author and lead solutions that would therefore stick in communities. And I think it's been proven to do that. And we started in London, as I said, and now we've replicated through a social franchising mechanism throughout the UK. And also we've opened a couple of schools internationally now and maybe more in the pipeline.
Thank you.
My name is Ilse Trionicht, and I'm from the Mars Discovery District in Toronto. Our particular government context in this morning's discussion is most relevant to the province of Ontario, Canada's most populous province, and one that, like many jurisdictions around the world, has been in the process of using both policy and investment levers to use innovation to transition its economy from a perhaps too heavy reliance on manufacturing. And that process has obviously been accelerated in the last year discontinuously with the economic transitions and particularly gut-wrenching transitions in certain communities and serious implications for spending in the public framework. The Mars Discovery District is located in Toronto and most importantly located in the heart of Toronto's Discovery District, which is Canada's largest science enterprise, directly adjacent to the University of Toronto and its affiliated teaching hospitals. It is a social enterprise. It was started by a group of civic entrepreneurs with philanthropic investment and business leaders really working in partnership with academic leaders as well as community leaders and ultimately three levels of government to create an innovation hub that had really three jobs. The first was to connect the communities of science, business, and money, foster collaboration between them, and really drive the process of accelerating innovation. Secondly, to re-engineer the process by which important discoveries from the surrounding and other academic institutions made their way, often unsuccessfully, to the marketplace or to patients. So that function of transitioning discovery to commercialization. And thirdly, to work with entrepreneurs to grow and scale their businesses. And that's really the engine room of the work of Mars. Shortly after Mars opened in the fall of 2005, the provincial government's innovation agenda specifically highlighted social innovation and the creative sector as part of that innovation economy. And by supporting a program of entrepreneurship at Mars, we have now fully integrated social entrepreneurship to sit adjacent to our work with information technology, healthcare, and green technology entrepreneurs. And so that's really the unique feature of this model, is that a little bit like Skoll almost, we've mainstreamed social innovation by first of all offering the resources that are typically available to technology entrepreneurs also to social entrepreneurs, but more importantly perhaps to make it part of a more holistic and perhaps pervasive culture of innovation.
Thank you. We'll just have a discussion here for a few minutes and then ask your questions. Let me start as a member of the panel and then revert to being the moderator here. So for the last 3 years, with a grant from a U.S. foundation called the Knight Foundation, I've convened U.S. social entrepreneurs and federal, city, and state officials, and look at the relationship between the sectors. And there are lots of, including many of you in the room, successful U.S. social entrepreneurs who really don't reach the level of scale to impact broadly social services, right? So they generally succeed by avoiding entanglement with government. And even the large successful ones, think Teach for America in the U.S., touch a very small percentage of the total education system. And you could do the same exercise with homelessness or whatever in the social sector. So the question becomes, how can you broadly create transformative change in areas of things I pay attention to, condensed poverty, if you're only touching part of the problem? And that is, and we were talking a little bit as we came in, this depends a little bit about kind of what your government like and what your culture like, but in the U.S., the government's the dominant funder of virtually every social sector service. So now that means that if you are a social entrepreneur and you get a foundation grant which serves as venture capital for yourself, or you're fortunate enough to come through ILSA's center or whatever the case may be, generally your funding is for 3 years. At the end of 3 years, then you're on your own. And generally a foundation that provides the funding says at the end of 3 years, the definition of success is that government takes over the funding of your program. Well, now this means that government is the marketplace, and there is no natural marketplace. And so if I'm a citizen in need of help, it's not like somebody has a good social program and I can find my way there and innovation produces scale, right? Because I can go buy my iPad if I like it, but I can't go buy my homeless shelter services if I like it, or in the U.S. school services. So we're trying to figure out how to create a market for change. Now, in this context, just a couple quick observations, and then I'll kind of give up the floor. One is that because government is such a significant funder, in many communities, the philanthropic funding begins to look a lot like government, right? There's not a lot of existing philanthropic resources that flow to new models. And I was the mayor of a city of a little less than a million in the U.S., and our giving to these programs was tended to be the same organizations each year. And generally what happened is those organizations would say, I've got a great idea, can I have some money? They'd get some money, they'd come back the next year and say, well, we didn't succeed, but the reason we didn't succeed is because we didn't have enough money, right? And that earned you the right to keep doing the same thing year after year with a little bit more money. And the result of that was it took the opportunity and resources out of the environment for the rest of the folks. Now, so what can be done? Oh, and by the way, I don't know what it's like in the various countries that are here, but in the U.S., the government also often restricts the types of providers by credentialing and other rules that make for a certain set of techniques that are licensed and available in these areas. And that also restricts the vibrancy of the social innovators. So what can we do about this? Well, one, it's just a little fund, but the $50 million fund that President Obama has set up basically says, we're going to fund innovation. We want you to have a model that appears to be working, And so instead of the usual government process, which is we would issue a request for proposals, and in the U.S. sense, those requests for proposals are written in such detail that they prevent innovation and transformation, right? Because they say, basically, the way you win is to think like us, and then you win. So the $50 million fund says, give us your ideas. And particularly, we like to fund intermediaries that would help with innovative responses. A second way to think about this, and I apologize, but my frame here mostly is U.S., is that there is a substantial role for social entrepreneurs on the demand side of this problem, right? Because we have a lot of suppliers of services, and their services appear to be working. But we don't have a huge demand for those services because there's not a marketplace for that demand. So the social entrepreneurs who use their resources to create a Web 2.0 demand, to create an advocacy effort, to create a program that produces change on the part of government, right? That lobbies government, that lobbies philanthropy. So we're trying to encourage social entrepreneurs to think about themselves as players on the demand side as well as the supply side. Think of yourself as virtually marching on City Hall with 2.0 tools or government and demanding change. Another way for social entrepreneurs to play in this particular area is that as we talk about scale, there's both an opportunity and a danger that social entrepreneurs define scale only as my program gets bigger. And that's a natural thing to do, right? I've got a program, it's helping 5,000 people, I want it to help 10,000 people. That is a legitimate definition of scale. But in the systems that we're talking about in many of these areas, individuals operate inside families, and they operate inside neighborhoods, and they operate inside communities and schools, and so they're operating inside a network. And so one way for a social entrepreneur to create substantial change is by developing an intervention that makes better the rest of the pieces around that individual, right? That touches and creates a network of those resources that manages better. Just to, you know, take a very simple example in U.S. terms, there's an organization called Communities and Schools. And basically, it took all of the services that were scattered around the neighborhood, touching the family in different places, and integrated them into the schools. It didn't just bring them into the schools, it managed them in the schools and made the resulting efforts that much better. So another way to think about scale with respect to social innovation is a scale that comes from a model which makes the rest of the system better, not just displaces it. In the end, and in conclusion, the President Obama's Social Innovation Fund may be effective with $50 million, but the only way it's really going to be effective if it convinces government that it has to repurpose the existing dollars that it's spending to dollars that demand performance. And then we will see the transformative change that we need, and thus far that we haven't. So with that, I've asked the minister how to address him, because he's a surgeon and a minister, so he suggests Vivian would be the right way to do this. So with all due respect, Vivian, why don't you, the Singaporean model is interesting both for cultural issues and because of what you've accomplished. So why don't you talk a little bit about the role of government in your sense, and then I'm going to ask our other panelists to comment about how they view government as either a support service or a problem.
When you're dealing with at the interface between government and social entrepreneurship, there are two key elements which I want to put on the table. The first is the central paradox that if there's government failure, there's actually a lot more scope for social entrepreneurship. Now, we can all agree that we all need governments to provide security, justice, healthcare, education, grow an economy, jobs, protect, empower women, and all those things. And the paradox is, if governments do all that, there's still stuff for social entrepreneurs, but much less. The most fundamental changes in social entrepreneurship actually occur where there's government failure. So you need to understand, particularly if you go into new jurisdictions, the big elephant in the room is the government and what it's doing and what it's not doing. And it's worth bearing that in mind because it also leads to potential political problems, because governments obviously, and especially governments that need to win elections, will have sometimes their own more short-term considerations. So that's the first point. There is a central paradox in the relationship between governments and social entrepreneurs. The second point, however, and this is speaking from a Singapore perspective, is that there is a very useful and functional partnership between governments and social activists, social entrepreneurs. Let me cite the Singapore example. We are probably a government that most of you in this room would classify as right of center, which means we believe that the individual is primarily responsible for his or her own affairs. We believe that you are also responsible for looking after your family. And the next layer, if you and your family can't cope, is the local community. And only after that does the government provide the basic fundamental social security. Now, in that model, and certainly in my jurisdiction, almost all our social services at the human interface is not delivered by government, but delivered by voluntary welfare organizations, delivered by social organizations, clan organizations, faith-based groups, etc., etc. The funding, however, as Stephen has alluded to, comes mostly from government and private philanthropy. Now, the reason we do this is not an accounting trick, but because of our belief that when you're trying to fix lives or transform lives, you're much better off doing that with people on the ground, with passion, with values, and with domain knowledge of what people need, what people want, and how to change people. And that's much better done by people like this rather than an army of civil servants. So I'm not necessarily convinced that we're saving money. You know, there's always this concept that governments can save money by outsourcing services to social organizations. I'm not sure that is the case, and in any case, that should not be the key imperative. The question is, who does it better? And I would suggest that there are many social interventions that are delivered much better by activists on the ground who really do want to make a change. And then the key thing is to manage that relationship. And again, as Stephen has alluded to, you know, not getting bogged down in filling up forms and submitting complicated requests for information and proposals which look like just another government paper. And then the difficulty then is measuring performance. Because do you give more to an organization that says it's got more clients, or do you actually measure success by the fact that you've run out of clients because people don't need you anymore? So it's a very complicated partnership and one which is imperfect. The third point I wanted to make, and this is with specific reference to Asia, is to understand that historically in Asian communities, governments have not been very activist on the social side of it. Asians have had to depend for millennia on their family, on their communities, on their clan associations, and more recently on trade unions. And in the case of Singapore, the key social enterprises of our trade unions are the cooperatives. You know, the cooperatives, for those of you who don't know, are, in a sense, they're business organizations, but they are owned by the beneficiaries. So the only shareholders are the people who consume the services, and any benefits arising from that business are confined to the customers. In the case of Singapore, that has actually been around for the last 90 years. It started off with shortage of money on the ground. You know, now you call it microfinancing. But in the old days, it's just, where can I find some place to leave money if I've got extra money to get some interest? And where can I borrow money if I need to? And the thrift and loan societies have grown. They're not banks, but they function. They play a crucial role in providing finance on the ground. Another area was in insurance, and I've got the CEO of the largest insurer in Singapore, which paradoxically is a cooperative, Mr. Tan Swee Chee, back there. So he doesn't have shareholders who collect dividends, but he's got to make sure he gives the best deal possible to the purchasers of his insurance. But we don't give him any benefits. It's a level playing field. He's got to fight with Prudential, with AIA, and all the other insurance companies. But it started off because there was a group of workers, low-income, high-risk jobs, whom commercial insurers were not interested in servicing. So again, from a need, and by organizing it, you can get a viable and crucial service delivered. Another example, in Asia, rice is a staple, and the price of rice is a key political issue. In the 1970s, when the oil embargo started and significant inflation swept through Asia, a key concern was the price of rice. We got the trade unions to start another cooperative, which we call Fair Price. Their key role was to become an efficient aggregator and purchaser of rice and to sell that to Singaporeans at a fair price, hence its name. Again, we had to do it in a way which would not give it an unfair advantage against commercial providers. So it still competes with the supermarkets. And paradoxically, again, in Singapore, it is probably in number one position as far as market share is concerned. So these are just some examples. But the point I wanted to illustrate is there's a paradox, but there are opportunities for partnership, sometimes difficult, and that in the case of Asia, there are often non-traditional forms of social enterprises which don't necessarily fit the new models which are being invented. But we in Asia are looking upon all these developments. The reason we're here is to see what new ideas and new models may possibly be applicable in Asia. So I'll stop there and hand it over to the real guys.
Yeah, so Alistair, so this all sounds too good to be true, so we'll make you the villain here. I was over at the Young Foundation earlier in the week. Most of us in the U.S. in this movement follow either Young or Jeff Mulgan or somebody. So you have this office of third sector, and you teach these social entrepreneurs. And when do your social entrepreneurs get too close to the fire? When is government the problem? Do you view that as a problem, and when do you view it as a asset and opportunity?
Well, it's intriguing because these people who have these ideas and are passionate about these ideas, and they make some headway with their idea, and all of a sudden they come into the view of government, and government thinks that's a sexy idea. They're doing an amazing job. We want to hook our truck to them, and they begin to kind of pull them in a bit, and they become the poster boys and girls of, innovation in this, that, or the other social issue. And because of the nature of social entrepreneurship, because of the fact that you initially, when you're sparking something off, you're beavering away just with you and your community, make something happen, the flattery and the legitimacy of the big boys, the government, with their might, and the dangling of mainstreaming, somewhere a million miles over there, is incredibly tempting to social entrepreneurs to jump into bed with that lot. So inevitably, loads of our students and practitioners really, are intrigued by that. And they think, well, here maybe is a source of ongoing revenues. Maybe we can use the data to kind of mainstream our lessons and scale the thing in some way. So they are flattered by that, and they do go down that route. And I was a student of the School for Social Entrepreneurs 12 years ago, and I had a project, and I remember being kind of picked up by government at the time and just thinking, oh, well, it'll all be sorted now. There'll be loads of money, and it'll all mainstream, and this will go all over Britain very quickly. And, of course, it didn't. And it was a waste of time. It was a huge waste of time for me and my project. And I ended up having to give talks and speeches at government events to civil servants endlessly, and there was nothing coming out of it. And I kept blaming myself and thinking, well, I'm doing something wrong here. There's something in the disconnect. But then if you think about it, if you think about what a bureaucrat is as a person, and that we need policy, we need politicians, we need bureaucrats, but they're very different than social entrepreneurs. And it's extremely difficult for them to understand us and for us to understand them. And I think, certainly, if you look back over the kind of 12, 13 years that British civil service and bureaucracy has been very intrigued with social entrepreneurship and social enterprise, if you look back at their kind of policy journey that they've gone on, it's quite intriguing. Because in the first instance, I remember when the first Social Enterprise Action Plan was published, and they were put as a department into the Department of Trade and Industry, so they saw us as a new form of doing business. And we were very excited to get a department and to get a kind of action plan. And so we all, when it was hot off the press, read through this action plan. No mention of social entrepreneurship or the doing word or about individuals, you know, leading and working with their communities to lead change. It was all about structures, and it was all about, you know, which was all very valid and all good and well. So it was about things like, you know, the idea of what we now have here, which is community interest company. It was around taxes, laws, structures, ways of doing business. Now, that's great, and that creates an environment where we can use these tools to make things happen. But the one thing that the British government... So they kind of went down that route, and that served a whole lot of purposes in terms of innovation in public services, outsourcing to new structures. But who was populating this with innovative ideas? And, of course, the thing they missed was that this is all about people. And the other thing they missed, which they were desperately keen to get, was this is also about reach. It's also about reaching into poor communities. And as we all know, because we're in the business of social change happens when you give power to people who understand the problem. And therefore, to structure your entire policy debate and discussion around structures... Surprise, surprise, it was a bunch of men in suits, white men in suits, who were round the table speaking about these structures and systems. So the whole policy objective of empowerment or liberating people to work in their communities and with their communities to create new solutions, they had completely missed it off the agenda. So it literally didn't feature in the first iteration. So then, of course, they regrouped, they were placed in a different department, they were shoved over in the cabinet office, and they kind of had a second iteration and a second go in it. And this time, it was much less around structures and social enterprise, if you will, in other words, trading for a social impact, which is the kind of broad definition here. And it was much more about social entrepreneurship. And it wasn't about, and I think this is uniquely a British thing as well, it wasn't about... social entrepreneurship as in the kind of hero, you know, international scaling idea that's going to change the world. It was a very British thing, which was about a kind of democratization of social entrepreneurship, which was about this being a long-tail sport, that if you're in any community in Britain and you have an idea and you've got a bunch of neighbours and you've got an innovative idea to create some community glue and get things going... Let's see if we can get a policy environment and support that's going to help you do that. So they then tilted very much to that angle. And just presumably a few of you might have seen the debate last night, but the manifestos for both sides, this is, we can't believe this, because Tory and Labour in their manifestos, it's all our stuff. The British election is being fought on social enterprise and social entrepreneurship. It's a battleground. And I'm telling you, in terms of, you know, way back when I was plucked by them and paraded as a kind of, here's an interesting idea, waste of time, red herring, I should have stuck to the knitting and got on with my project. But actually, I now see why government is hugely important. Because if you can get in the centre ground and you can influence, even although they don't understand social entrepreneurs, and by the very nature of these people who have done very well at school, very well at university, you know, they understand didactic training and learning. You know, the idea of what a social entrepreneur might need by way of support is, it's over their head. I mean, they can't get it. So I think it's about, we need to respect the difference, and we need to understand the big prize is there in terms of social innovation and mainstreaming, but we need to also help them understand that there are many policy objectives that they can get to using these tools. One is innovation in public services and kind of outsourcing in kind of new and interesting ways. And great if they're opening that market to social enterprises, great. We will choose whether we want to take them up on that challenge and whether we want to deliver. We don't need to. We can ignore the calls to tender. But also, fantastic if they are beginning to see social entrepreneurship as a tool for devolving power and mobilising communities. And I think that certainly is where both Labour and Tories are at the moment, and that's the very exciting agenda in Britain. And that has tilted completely away from structure towards people, and really, and I've got to say, weirdly, because I know them all now in this office of the third sector, they're good people, and they're trying to author good policy, but it's taken them a long time to get their head around it and to get it into some sort of shape that we're beginning to read the documents and thinking, actually, that makes sense.
Well, Ilse, Alistair started by insulting Vivian and me, calling us hopeless bureaucrats, and then he ended up complimenting us because we had accepted his policies. That's kind of what I heard. Right? So, along the way, there was this issue of structure, and you might provide an interesting option here, because it looks to me like you're an intermediary between government and some of the folks you're nurturing. Tell us about that structure and whether that helps kind of broker against these elements that Alistair mentioned.
Well, I think just following up on Alistair's comment, I think many people around the world look with some envy to the mainstreaming of social entrepreneurship as part of an election platform, because I do think government sets an important tone in saying that, and just as President Obama has as well, social innovation is important and we want to create a public policy environment in which social entrepreneurs can flourish. There's lots of details that follow that, you know, may or may not hit the right spots at the right time. I think the model we have is a little bit of an intermediate space where after government took that first step of identifying this as important, it said we really want to encourage social entrepreneurs, but we're going to partner with an arm's length entity that is totally and entirely dedicated to working with entrepreneurs. But we want to have that relationship in a way that is very tethered in the context of, as hotspots of innovation or promising enterprises are identified, they can be brought back to government to, you know, either be levered into the government programs or be supported as external enterprises in a way that is both efficient, but more importantly, is also evidence-based. Because I think the one recognition we've had is that there's a real challenge inside government, and perhaps the minister could echo this, to really understand the efficiency of social programs across a whole range of metrics for all the historic reasons of how they get set up initially. So perhaps I have a slightly more optimistic view than Alistair about the partnership between social entrepreneurs and government, but it is a precarious relationship that needs to be managed very, very carefully because of that paradox that you heard about. There is no question, though, that important social enterprises can and need to leverage the system changing effects of partnership with government if they really want to matter, and sometimes that happens in the context of how they morph. So to just give you an illustrative example of that, the social entrepreneurship node of Mars is part of a slightly peculiar partnership across Canada, and Canada has the exact opposite challenge of Singapore. It is a vast country with not very many people in it, so we have to set up often peculiar networks of collaboration to get shared expertise and critical mass. So our node is bolted onto a family foundation node, the McConnell Family Foundation in Montreal, which has a long history of funding leading Canadian social entrepreneurs, and a very strong social enterprise called Plan in Vancouver, that is also very deeply embedded in the very vibrant social finance and social enterprise community in Vancouver. But the story of Plan is it started 20 years ago by two remarkable social entrepreneurs, Elliot Mansky and Vicky Kamak, focused really on family-based and community-based caregiving solutions for families with disabilities, children with disabilities, because they had a disabled child themselves. So it was very much that organic enterprise growing up around local need. As they obviously progressed with that enterprise, and it was very successful in the context of building informal caregiving networks and making sure those get connected to the more structured formal caregiving networks, they realized that one of the profound challenges, two profound challenges for people with disabilities. The first is financial security, because this generation of disabled children will outlive their parents. And the second was that the most profound challenge of disabled individuals is their profound sense of isolation. And so they started to focus their own work to develop more scalable solutions to address those two challenges. And the first was a very innovative process, which again they then started to draw on this wonky network across the country, because to actually develop a social finance instrument that will allow you to develop financial assets for children with disabilities, and this is a deferred tax exempt instrument, they needed to get not only those individuals and their families on board, but provincial governments as well as the federal government and the financial institutions who would ultimately need to sell that instrument. Now, this was a torturous road, but about a year ago, Canada launched the first in the world registered disability savings plan, which is now available to over 500,000 eligible families and individuals in Canada, and is sold through the mainstream banks. So that's a very classic example where the partnership with government was really important. To deal with the second piece of the sense of isolation, Plan has now developed a very innovative and award-winning social networking solution called TYZE, T-Y-Z-E, and I encourage anybody to look at that, which is a very private, focused network of putting the disabled individual or the disadvantaged individual in the middle of the social network and creating a caregiving community around that. So, and that is now going international and, again, is being adopted in the UK by the NHS and a number of other government agencies. So a productive relationship to get to scale without warping and perhaps actually enabling a larger level of innovation is possible. But it depends not just on, default personalities government and social entrepreneurs easily adopt. It depends very much on visionary leadership inside the individual government departments to take and pull.
It's very helpful. This is, a description of what Alistair sometimes overhears called the kind of co-production of services, right? You have a government role and a community role in this intermediary. There's a case study, a Harvard case study that I'll summarize in like 1 minute. Basically, it's a state of Oklahoma in the U.S. that used to pay in the disability world for job coaches for individuals with disabilities to help those people, and they would coach them every day, even through the time they got the job. Mm-hmm. And because the government was paying for job coaches by the day, they got days of job coaching and more days of job coaching and more days of job coaching. And then one day the government bureaucrat, mm-hmm, who had been on the social sector side, said, well, why don't we just pay for the outcomes? And we'll pay more for job outcomes for more severely disabled folks. Well, the government's change from paying for activities to paying for outcomes unleashed a great deal of innovation in that sector. I have a lot more questions for the panelists, but I'd also like to see if we have questions here. And I'm going to ask the first question to a non-panelist. I've just finished this book on power of social innovation. I did these case studies of leading U.S. social entrepreneurs, and in the room today is one of the most successful, Dorothy Stoneham from an organization called Youth Build, who insists that she's able to maintain her own passion, commitment, and mission despite massive amounts of government funding. So could you just defend yourself to the rest of the audience? Why have you been successful enough to utilize really, you're a very large scale organization, and how have you maintained your commitment to your core passion and mission despite the demands of the government bureaucrats?
Gee, 10 seconds?
I'd say a minute and a half would be fine, yeah.
It's a great, fascinating challenge, in fact, and I'm writing down some nice quotes from you, like a productive relationship to get to scale without warping the innovation is possible, but it depends very much on visionary leadership inside the government. And I think for us, and I'll just say over the past 14 years, we have generated about $800 million that has gone direct to local programs. It doesn't go through us as the intermediary. Local programs compete for it, and then they have to implement the social innovation, which we defined, and we defined it in both by example and in law. So the model is one where we created a federal program, and then the government contracts with us to provide training, technical assistance, and inspiration to the local programs, which they choose to fund on a competitive basis to implement our social innovation. So we kind of define it as, you know, the government is the ocean liner and we're the tugboat. The government provides the engine and the resources, but we're whipping around on the outside and we're helping the local organizations and we're correcting the mistakes of government. We're persuading the government what direction to go in. And it's a very constant interaction between us as the national nonprofit source of the movement building, inspiration, cutting edge, catalytic change, as well as the original vision, and the government with the accountability and the metrics and the funding and the competition and the, you know, and sometimes they think they're our boss and sometimes we think we're their boss. And sometimes we tell government, we tell the Congress how they should change the law in order to make the government do what it should do, and sometimes, you know, the government tells us what we have to do in order to meet their standards. And it's a never-ending partnership, negotiation, depends very much, and over 20 years there have been very many different people in government who are responsible for implementing the Youth Build Program, which is what it's called. And depending on who that person is at any given time, it goes better or worse. And depending on how much creative leadership the person above that so-called bureaucrat provides, the political appointee, how much they understand our vision, it goes better or worse. We provide the historical vision, we provide the long-term view, one of the first bureaucrats who was in charge of it in one federal agency is now the chairman of our board in the national nonprofit, because he was so good at it, we pulled him over, right, and when he left the government. So I don't know if this answers your question, but it is certainly dynamic, challenging, exciting, and, you know, we have been able to make substantial change by generating these resources and working with
that's,
government.
Let me turn that into a question to Vivian. So in this book I've just finished, The Power of Social Innovation, we've held up Dorothy as kind of the leading example of how to maneuver, you know, maintain your sense of balance between these. But what she just mentioned, Vivian, I heard loudly, is she found a champion inside government who could kind of protect her right to innovate. So what's your model look like without you, right? I mean, what's the danger that somebody less sensitive to the flexibility necessary for the social innovator takes your place and is more more prescriptive with respect to the requirements?
I think you got to make it individual proof, because otherwise it will not be sustainable for the long term. The key thing to managing the relationship is to understand that it is a difficult relationship, but it needs to have trust and respect mutually. And the other big problem is measuring outcomes. It's easy to measure inputs. It's somewhat more difficult, but it's still relatively easy to measure outputs. But outcomes, social outcomes, are very difficult to measure. And the trouble is that for governments and bureaucracy, you know, you've got huge piles of money and you want to spend it, but you're accountable for it and you need some kind of metrics to justify why you've spent it. And sometimes the relationship gets caught in political polemics. You know, how can you not do more for a disabled child? instead of focusing on what is the outcome, what is a proper and reasonable and accurate measurement of that outcome, and therefore it justifies it. Remember, at the end of the day, the bureaucrat and the activists are actually on the same side. They all want to do more and to do the best for the beneficiaries. So I think if we can get the respect, if we can get some understanding, and if the activist learns to speak some bureaucracy, and the bureaucrat learns, you know, what is it that the activist is trying to achieve, I think it can be a much more productive outcome.
So I agree with everything you said.
So two things. One, if you want, if you have a question, raise your hand, and this fleet of foot fellow in the orange will find you with the mic. Let's go up here. And while we do that, Alistair, you have an example of, I think this debate between outputs and outcomes is really quite important, because sometimes the perfect does become the enemy of the good. Do you have an example of the kind of output measurement that you think has driven a social entrepreneur that you've assisted?
I think I would challenge that a little bit. Social entrepreneurs use the currency of trust in terms of creating things and making things happen. In their communities, they are often selfless in the way that they build momentum behind ideas. There is a huge push in the UK to unitize and matrix impact and outcomes, and a laudable push and all good stuff, to measure everything within an inch of its life. Now, the truth of the matter is that we need to make a choice in terms of, do we want to build and cement a contract-based culture or a trust-based culture? If we're looking to empower the poorest who are not in the system, we have got to fund with an element of, as you were saying in the outset, in terms of your fund and the kind of openness of your fund, we've got to be comfortable to take some risks and push things down and fund in a trusted way, as opposed to trying to kind of contract manage every kind of output. I think it's quite a fundamental discussion. The other thing is, obviously, the politicians in the UK have lost public trust, full stop. The banks have lost public trust, full stop. Guess what two sectors are desperately knocking at our door to do partnerships? And I think we need to think long and hard about, yes, we need to do those partnerships, but we need to think about what we've got as a currency, as a movement, as social entrepreneurship, social enterprise, and we need to bargain carefully with that. And we use the currency of trust remarkably effectively to create value. And I think we need to be extremely aware of that in our negotiations going forward. So I'm not a huge fan of kind of contract output, outcome measurement to the nth degree. I believe push money down, give people freedom, and see what happens is also incredibly useful.
First outbreak of just applause. Yes, sir, would you speak loudly and kind of tell us who you are as you ask your question, please?
My name is Jack Sim. I'm the founder of the World Toilet Organization, and I'm from Singapore. So basically, everybody is aligned. They want to make change. They want to make it happen, but their incentive system is rather different. The bureaucrats is incentivized to play it safe, to pretend that he's doing a good job, to pretend that there's no problem, and that the current situation is rather good, and the social entrepreneur is coming to make it better. The social entrepreneur has a burning desire to solve a problem. So in this conflict of interest, we have to give the bureaucrat a lot of safety in case he put up the hand and say, actually, this whole place is so screwed up that I need the social entrepreneur. When he say that, he becomes very vulnerable. So how do we reconcile these two situations so that the bureaucrat who is really interested to solve the problem is safe to put his hand up and say, I want to solve this problem. Whereas current system is the bureaucrat, if he follow the rules and just hide around and camouflage himself, he gets to retirement safely, and nothing really disastrous happened. But if he take a risk on a social entrepreneur, and it takes some time, and the result haven't come yet, but he trusts this guy, maybe he get questions, right. And he's not protected.
So this is a great question. I'm going to ask the panelists when they respond to the questions to kind of respond briefly, because we do have a number of hands up, and everybody will have a response. My 30-second response is, this is a brilliant question for which there's no answer. B, it could take an elected leader or a cabinet minister, and that person can be the champion for room for change, right? Obama has $50 million. Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York City has created a $200 million social venture fund. And so the bureaucrats who administer the fund are administering a fund where the person who has the public profile has said, this is a fund for change. Now, it doesn't totally resolve the problem. I'm administering this problem for President Obama, and I've kind of joked with the folks in the White House that I'm supposed to go to Congress and say, we've only failed half the time with our fund, and that's the definition of innovation, right? So it just feels like I'll be a little bit vulnerable, but they've said, you know, kind of go for it. Quick responses from anybody?
I would say twofold. Get the bureaucrats and the ministers out to visit you lot, and get the odd able person to go in. So Campbell Robb, who was the Director General of the Office of the Third Sector, who led all this stuff, was actually from the NGO sector and went into the bureaucracy. So I think mixing the cultures is useful, if we could ever bear to go in there.
All right, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The model we've created is a little bit of a create a neutral space that is not government, not business, not academe, not, you know, where those parties can all come together, and then as sort of a facilitated and funded sandbox where government is a key partner, and it can watch almost the experiment being conducted and has the ongoing commitment to take solutions that emerge and support and fund them. So at the same time, if something really wacky happens out there, the risks are somewhat boxed, and they can blame us for stimulating those.
All right. Yeah, yes, sir. And then we'll down here, and then we'll jump up to the back. Or over. I don't know. How many mics do we have? Two? Three? Well, let's take this gentleman in the blue, and then pick somebody up in the kind of wherever we can't see up here. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Jason Saul. I run an advisory firm called Mission Measurement. I just want to make one quick comment and a question. The comment, Alistair, is related to measuring, you know, the outputs. My concern is actually, I see somewhat the opposite, where there's actually too much trust. We're spending a tremendous amount of money, and we have absolutely no idea what's going on out there. And I think that's actually creating more distrust, because the cost of what works, the cost of I don't know is getting pretty high, right? And so I feel like, I think there's some very good proxy metrics for outcomes that we can get as leading indicators of what's going to happen, that we don't have to wait 10 years and see. There's been a lot of, in many, many fields, a lot of that work. So I do think that I'm hopeful that we can find some short-term proxy, clever metrics that are indicators of ultimate outcomes and not just measure the throughput of the organization. The second is, I'm a Kennedy School alum, and my question to all of you is, how do we remove the "and" from the title of this session? How do we get social entrepreneurs into government? Why is it always government and social entrepreneurs? Why aren't all of us working in government, and how do we get more of us young, smart, idealistic people to actually get in there and take over some of the levers of influence?
Well, we'll give Vivian the first, since Singapore has a reputation of having maybe the highest performing government in the world. We'll let him explain how he attracts all these folks, and then...
Well, I'll just give a short answer to that. In Singapore, we have no professional politicians. All of us have had a life. And if you've had a life, you've got some track record of success, you've got trust, and you've got competence. You know, good luck to you. And we would try to recruit people. But it's a very odd place, so it's not a prescription I can wish upon anyone else. but your point is, you need that type of mentality, that type of activism and passion within government as well. I totally agree with you.
Somebody up there, hold up there. Oh, you got the mic. Okay, thank you.
Hi, Rick Blickstead with...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just totally offended the guy in the front row who I've been telling like for 10 minutes I'm going to call on him. So just hold on.
Well, he's a keener down there at the front, so you go ahead first.
He's more visible than you are, too.
And you were hiding up the back there, so you might be interested.
Yes, sir.
It's Toby Eccles from Social Finance. Sort of a couple of comments and a question. The first is this debate around accountability and risk management being the background flavor when you're in government versus trust and let us just get on with it on the social entrepreneur side. And the need for measurement if you're in government versus the we should get on with it if you're on the entrepreneurial side. Just first comment, speaking as spending the last 2 years closing a transaction with government, which may indicate a range of the issues concerned, that you can't get away from democratic accountability in a democracy. You might be able to intermediate it. And your comment, I thought, was very interesting about the idea that you can potentially put in an entity that's in charge of trying to develop the long-term outcome, and they then have sub, maybe more trusting relationships with a series of social entrepreneurs to deliver on that outcome. But you going direct and then trying to do it at scale, my present experience is it doesn't work unless an organization builds the program at the beginning and then does it for 20 years, and then they're in a different place. Output versus outcome, here's where I first disagreement with Alistair, I guess, is that I can't put them in the same category. They are fundamentally, one is a measure of process, and government's habit of measuring everyone else on process, then looking for the cheapest process, and then wondering why they didn't get the outcome, is probably one of the most deeply frustrating aspects of dealing with government. That is one that gets my hackles up. The trouble with going for outcome is that it takes a while to work out what it was.
It's damn difficult.
And so the next element, which we're looking at and which are interesting in the panelists as to how one develops a marketplace for it, is one needs to be able to finance outcomes. Social entrepreneurs can't take the risk of waiting for 3 years to get paid and not knowing whether they're going to get paid. So developing, and the bit that we're becoming interested in, is how does one develop a market in outcome finance?
Okay. Takers?
You might need to explain to people about your social impact bond. It's worth explaining, because it's a real example of this concept in practice.
I'll be as brief as I can. Sorry, Stephen.
I've lost control of my panel there.
It's good. It's good. I always like that bit.
Talking about being disintermediated really quickly.
In essence, we have agreed a contract with the Ministry of Justice in the United Kingdom.
Speak just a little louder.
We've agreed a contract with the Ministry of Justice in the United Kingdom who will pay for us to avoid offenders from being reconvicted. And that's on a well-defined amount, so you will get paid this amount of money for every conviction that does not happen against a control group. Now, we've used that contract to set up a fund to raise money now to pay for the set of services that will try and produce that outcome. So that's, if you like, that definition of intermediation. The trick is everyone's, as you say, it becomes the sexy thing. It's in the Labour Party manifesto. It's in the Conservative Party manifesto. The trouble is we've now going to raise £5 million, but actually we can't go to £100 million because there's no track record yet. So it's this intervening period of trying to build out an outcome finance marketplace.
I was talking about this, I didn't realize I was talking about you earlier. So I want to go back there, but let me ask you a real quick question. I'm government, okay, in this conversation. And I love this model of paying you for folks not to reoffend. Just talk for a minute about how you don't gravitate to the easier of the felons.
That's actually relatively easy. You get the metric right. So if we're focusing on reconviction rate, then those who are bound to reconvict anyway, you would ignore, okay? But if you focus on the total number of convictions across the population, then working with someone who is going to get convicted time and time again and just get them only getting reconvicted occasionally as you slowly change their life around is just as worthwhile, if not more worthwhile, than working with the guy who might be able to stop reconvicting.
But how do you count? I don't want to get too caught up in you, but how do you count the number of convictions you prevent?
by having a control group.
So it's just gross numbers in the control group.
Well, your control group is picked to be as similar as possible, and they do the total number of convictions on your group, total number of convictions on the alternative group, and get paid for the difference.
Yeah, this is a really important conversation, obviously worthy of like another 7 hours. Just real quickly, we've reached an outcome compromise with President Obama's fund in the following way. We haven't actually picked the people who are going to win yet, so this is just take this as a hypothetical. But so we're going to get, and this just goes right in the heart of the conversation, but it might provide an example. So U.S. is now fixated on these horrible, except for Dorothy's program, high school graduation rates in the U.S., which are just kind of catastrophically awful. And so we'd like to cause them to occur. But it looks like the reading levels of third and fourth graders are statistically correlated to whether they eventually will graduate in the 12th grade. But we're not going to have a 15-year funding, you know, and then say. So we're probably going to end up with something that looks like the following. If your program helps kids read at grade level over a two-year period of time in the grades that make a difference, that's an output that we think is, by other empirical results, connected to the outcome we want, and we'll fund that. So that's just one kind of potential compromise. That was very interesting. Thank you for calling on him. It was excellent. Well, very well done. Yes, sir.
Hi, Rick Blickstead with the Wellesley Institute in Toronto. I'd like to pose a question to the panel regarding the risk-reward. You know, having been in the private sector and come into the third sector, I'm actually quite amazed how good and honest bureaucrats are. 99.9% of them are really trying to make a difference. The system is very difficult for them to do that. And so when I meet with deputy ministers or other people in government, the challenge is they're not paid to take risks because they are the guardians of the public trust, of the taxpayers' money. And I'm not sure that will ever change. And so therefore, when I say we can get 4 out of 10 successes, they're paid to get 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10. So my question is, just like we've had to outsource access to capital, can you outsource access to risk? Now, the UK tried to do it, I understand, and sort of offloaded some of these decision-making. But I am convinced that we're barking up the wrong tree on this, that we're not going to get governments to accept that kind of venture entrepreneurship risk-taking. And is there a mechanism, therefore, to change that? Ilsa talked about Mars, but I'd like to hear how you might be doing it. And to say hello to Jack, who I attended Harvard with in the nonprofit program, and he's building toilets all over the world and making a better place for people. So congratulations to you, Jack. Sorry.
These are great questions. Let's do Vivian and then Alistair, and then who's got the next question so we can get over on the mic? Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say that's a very fundamental point worth appreciating. I always view government money as dumb money. Sounds paradoxical, right? If we in government understood risk and were willing to bear the risk, and we understood entrepreneurship and were able to start things up, we shouldn't be in government. We should be an entrepreneur or we should be an activist. So the key to getting this right is to assemble a coalition. So for instance, if I need to assess a proposal, it shouldn't be done unilaterally by me. The business side of it, if I can get a real entrepreneur to examine the business case, the social outcomes, if I can get someone with proper ability to give me measurements and to say, yes, this is the right metrics and this is not, then what government can do is we can provide some of that dumb money as seed funding, as leverage funding, but ride on the risk assessment capability of people out there who are able to do that, and ride on the passion and domain knowledge of the social activists out there who understand the needs of the beneficiaries. The problem we will get is when any one of these triangular parties starts to say, I'm preeminent and I know it all. So if we understand that, and we know what we know and we know what we don't know, and when we need the others, I think it's possible to create it. So in case of Singapore, for instance, I have a social enterprise fund, and I start off by being a skeptic. But I put the money there anyway. If a social entrepreneur comes up to me and says, take it on trust, I say, I'm sorry, chum, that's not enough. I need you to get together with someone else who will also be able to provide the performance metrics. And if you tell me this is going to make money, come in with another entrepreneur who's put in some of his own money, then I'm more willing to trust because you've put your money where your mouth is and I'm willing to take a risk on you. And if things go wrong, I'm accountable to the public. But nevertheless, I have shown due process and a certain amount of sense, common sense in approaching it. So that's how we do it in Singapore. Government money never goes in as 100% infusion. It's always co-funding. And we always want to see who your partners are. And that's why, in fact, this conference in social entrepreneurship and the key obsession now with joining the dots between people who have been investment bankers before, who understand finance, people who've started up companies, people who care deeply about causes, and then getting the relationship right with government is so crucial. And I see this SCOLE World Conference, this conference as an opportunity to develop those relationships and performance metrics. So I agree totally with what you're proposing.
Ilse, do you have something you want to say?
I came to this world similar to Rick from the private sector, and I want to make another observation that has been a big surprise to me. I've been really surprised at how reluctant government is to stop doing certain things. And if we really want, even when, you know, the evidence seems to be pretty clear that it's not working, and if we want to bring new innovation into government, we're going to have to stop doing things to make room for new things. And that's something I have no idea how we're going to address.
That is the problem. All right, I think what we'll do here is we've got a lot of hands up. We'll take two or three questions without having us respond. So who has a mic up here? And then there's a whole group of questions in here. Yes.
Hello, my name is Lars Johansson. I'm from the Scandinavian think tank Monday Morning. We work for social innovation and society. And I couldn't help, I have a comment and a question. A comment to Alistair, because I took your comment on white men in suits in. And I think you also have to appreciate when you talk about governments and social entrepreneurs that, for instance, the British government, they've, you know, the guys from OTS, they've been on a learning journey too.
Yeah.
I mean, you criticize them for getting it wrong the first time, but for others who are now learning from the British example, it's fantastic because, you know, we might be able to leap the 10 years you took in 3 years because of the mistakes and the learnings you've made along the way. So I think that's an important perspective to take in when you talk about cooperation with, you know, governments and governments facilitating social entrepreneurs. Now, in Denmark, we just led a major task force creating the first blueprint for a Danish national strategy for social entrepreneurship, you know, including both the suit government guys and the social entrepreneurs. And that makes me want to pose a question to Vivian. From the lessons you've made, what's the key policy or the key instrument that you from government in Singapore has developed that you feel has made, you know, the greatest difference to social entrepreneurship in Singapore?
I think what I'm going to do is, would you guys just write down, you can pick the questions you want to ask, and let's get two or three of these up in a row, and then because I think it'll give people a better chance to participate. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Ehsan Jameel, and I'm from the Aman Foundation, which is based out of Pakistan. We're involved in health, education, and nutrition. We're a new foundation. My question to the panel is that in Pakistan, where government is another kind of entity than what we see in Britain, USA, and Singapore, the role of the social entrepreneur is that much more critical in providing services, etc. I'd like to hear a little bit more from the panel about countries like Pakistan and India and Iraq, etc., which have an absence of real government.
It's an excellent question. Let's take one more, and then we'll get some answers, and then we'll take another round, and then we'll be out of time. Right behind you there. Thank you.
Yeah. Actually, my question is quite related to the question of the gentleman from Pakistan, because I'm actually in admiration with the systems that we are hearing right now, but my question is, how do you deal with the context of a lot of developing countries where you have endemic corruption and endemic threats within the government. Like, the government sometimes colludes with the people you're fighting against. The government is sometimes on the payroll of criminals. And sometimes they use they use the social sector as fake NGOs so that they can funnel money back into their pockets. So, yeah, I'd like to hear some advice how to deal with that kind of system.
Okay, one more question, and then we'll answer some of these.
Okay, this is more of a comment to the question that you made, the point that you made about government being paid to get 9 out of 10 successes rather than 4 out of 10. If you look at the track record of the public-private partnerships with big business rather than social entrepreneurs, or if you look at the track record of outsourcing to big business, and I come from big business, you see that the track record isn't 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10. It is actually kind of much more along the lines of what we're talking about in social enterprise. So I think the key thing there is, like, looking at the baseline, the kind of benchmarking with other areas are already kind of getting a lot of traction.
Okay. We'll just start down the panel and start with you, Vivian, and explain how you're going to solve these difficult problems.
The key lesson I've learned, and it's not just in this field, is to get the right people, get them organized, and then empower them to do what needs to be done. And it's all about right people and relationships. And if you've got the wrong people and the wrong motivations and the wrong teams, you're going to get all kinds of dysfunctional outcomes. The question on states with, more esoteric forms of government is complicated. And I don't think any one of us wants to make unnecessary comments which will get us into problems. But let me just state, again, from our perspective, in Singapore, we believe the first and most paramount attribute of government is honesty. If you don't have an honest government, or if you have a corrupt government, you can't get off the ground. And that is something which needs to be fixed at the political level. And there's no amount of intervention externally that is going to do that. And I understand what you mean, that sometimes you get perverse relationships. And the truth is, and I think you need, those of you in this room need to know, there's actually quite a lot of money to be made from social activism, from philanthropy. And there are people out there who will take advantage of it. And the point then is that good intentions are not enough. You need to have accountability and you need to have outcome measurements. Otherwise, you cannot hold all the parties to this ecosystem to account. So, and that's why I have to disagree with Alistair, that trust me is enough. It may be good enough in your society. It doesn't work universally. The final point about risk, reward, and expecting it to succeed 9 out of 10 times, I don't think that's necessarily true. We all know, certainly those who have done business, you can't succeed 9 out of 10 times. And I think that's why this whole process of intermediation by organizations like you or now, if we can get the financial sector or the business sector to come in and intermediate that risk, so that if I then end up with a portfolio of projects, and even if the majority of them fail, but on those which succeed, I emerge net positive, enough to be able to explain to my people why I took their tax dollars and took those risks, I think governments will be more willing to take those risks. So again, it's this trust and risk ratio which you need to manage.
Alistair.
Yeah, I think I wasn't really clear with what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, I mean, obviously you need to understand, for instance, with rehabilitation of offenders, is the inputs, are the outputs of what you're doing, are they having the desired effect? So I'm not against matrix measuring and outputs and impact per se. What I'm saying is we need to do both, because if you are trying to engage people who really are disengaged, then if the benchmark is to buy contracts of particular types to deliver particular you know, outputs or impact, or sorry, outcomes or impacts, it all gets very confusing, then actually you cut off that lifeline of those people having a stake in getting involved. Now, the problem is that's very messy. That's people, that's a lot of people, and therefore the way of doing it is And obviously we know governments don't like that because they have accountability, it's tax-based dollars or whatever, and therefore they've got to do something about it. So the way that it works, for instance, with us, is our government realises that they do need to back people on a trust basis in the poorest communities without matrix and without big barriers to engage and to begin that journey. And therefore what they do is they've funneled millions through us in order that the risk is distanced. So the OTS have backed us to back fledgling social entrepreneurs in the poorest estates in Britain to begin these ideas. Now, if we said, actually, we don't back on trust, we only use matrix, let's get a few MBAs to work in what matrix works, actually, you're cutting out the exact currency that you're trying to achieve, which is trust and community glue in poorer communities, and inclusion. You're cutting all that out of the equation. So it's not an either-or, it's a both. And we need matrix for scaled things and for public services, but also we need interventions that reach out and devolve power to people who are cut out of power.
Are you working with anybody who's... Have you funded or trained folks working in countries where the government's the problem?
No, it's not my area. I can't really answer those questions. Although I've got to say, to the chap from Monday Morning Think Tank, what a dreadful thought! Monday Morning Think Tank. My brain doesn't start working until Tuesday afternoon. I've got to say also, I realise how lucky we are in Britain. I said to the boss of OTS, you know, I think Britain, it's a shame because we're kind of policy leaders in this area. It's a shame we're not allowed to sell policy. Because with our deficit, we need to sell something overseas quickly. And it's a shame the bureaucrats can't flog it. Because I tell you, you go around the world and their brainstorms consist of clicking on the OTS website and downloading all the materials. So I am well aware how privileged we are and how much our government have engaged in this. And I congratulate them. And actually, they're a great bunch of people. But it's just what is interesting is their journey to get to where they've got to.
We're sensitive to the fact that you've a number of you asked questions that are not the panel's not representative or qualified to answer, I mean, with respect to what happens when the government's the problem, other than other governments and worldwide funders of NGOs need to be sensitive about how they spend their money. Let's get one last answer. Yeah, you can pick any one of these questions and you can answer it.
I think I just have to echo that. I think we have no, there's no getting away from measurements, and you know, there's some rational balance we have to strike. And I think it's imperative upon the social entrepreneurial community to work very closely with the funders, whether they're in government or in foundations, to try and keep the measurement systems rational and relevant to actually doing social entrepreneurial businesses.
So we appreciate that several people had questions, and this is a really well-informed audience, so we encourage you to continue the conversation, but the people in charge of the room have asked me to ask you to encourage you to continue your conversations outside the room and exit relatively quickly. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Have you been to Singapore?
No, I'd like to.
Bring you out here.
I'd like to do it. Harvard has a